You're listening to Unterwegs, the En Route podcast, where we talk about what it means to be en route with Jesus in our day-to-day life. Navigating life and faith in our complex and changing society is hard. Our goal is to keep you unterwegs with Jesus, moving forward as you follow God's calling on your life. Welcome to Unterwegs, the En Route podcast. I'm your host, Mike Piccinato, and this is episode 34. We're joining you again after a really long pause, and this is an unusual podcast and also the first one that we've done together as Envision staff. So I will go around the table and make introductions. To my right is Dr. Stephen W. Jones.
Hello.
And his wife, Jenny, is joining us.
Hi.
And my wife is joining us for the first time as well. Alyssa, welcome.
Hello.
Today we're talking about an issue on March 21st. It's day 25 of the war in Ukraine. And this hits us maybe a little differently than it hits people that are listening to the podcast, in part because we're really pretty close to everything that's happening in Ukraine. The city of Lviv, where a lot of the refugees are fleeing right now, right across the border from Poland, is just under normal traffic conditions, a 10-hour drive away from Berlin. And Kyiv is 900 miles from Berlin. It's about the distance from Minneapolis to Dallas. So everything that's happening is pretty close to us. And so I know that's impacted us as a team in a variety of ways. And I wanted to just take some time to talk about that because it's also part of our intercultural adjustment and how we are learning to live in an international city. And I say that as somebody who's been here for 10 years, what does it mean to live here? And so just take some time for us to respond with all of the differences that make up the Envision Berlin team to some questions. And one of those is do you remember any initial thoughts as you heard about Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
I remember some of my first thoughts were of disbelief and also that I was very concerned for especially one young lady that was an exchange student in our town and in our church over 10 years ago that I've stayed in contact with, and so wondering how she and her family were doing. And then also the feeling of, oh no, it's happening again because of the Syrian crisis that is still not resolved.
I think some things that came to my mind was also disbelief. Like the thought of, you know, different countries, you know, have conflicts all the time. They usually resolve them before it gets too deep. And so it was like, oh, this isn't resolving. Negotiations aren't the thing that's fixing whatever the problem was set out to be. And then I think even, I mean, it's continued to be the recognition of how close it is. I think that's also, yeah, constantly surprises me.
Maybe, oh gosh, a couple months before this recent escalation, one of my former students had reached out and asked what I was hearing about Russia and Ukraine. And this was somebody who had taken U.S. foreign policy with me and international relations with me. And so it was kind of funny because I really wasn't paying attention to the news at that point. We were still very much in kind of the midst of some of the heavy part of our transition here. And so when he asked about it, I was like, oh, no, I have no idea. And so, but then in the weeks leading up, it started to become very much something that seemed like it was likely going to happen. And I remember the night before, just, yeah, I did not sleep well. It was just this feeling of dread. I think there's a line in The Lord of the Rings where maybe it's Mary or Pippin, I can't remember, talks about just how terrible it is to be waiting on the edge of a battle that you can't avoid. And of course, we are not at this point in the conflict, but you know, that anticipation, I remember feeling that. Yeah. And just the tragedy that was about to happen.
I think for me, I find myself from a historic perspective looking at the situation with a sense of disbelief and irritation. Irritation that after Georgia, after Crimea, after 14 years now that things have been happening, that that people just kind of assumed, I'll just give him a little more and it will go away, give him a little more and it will go away. So kind of irritation at the lack of response beforehand, and then disbelief that Putin would actually do this. And then, of course, as Alyssa said, concern for people we knew, and then just because we were here in 2015 during the Syrian refugee crisis, just the feeling, the question of, or the sense maybe that everything is about to shift again. Stephen, in a non-scripted question, I know this for you probably hits a little differently because there were parts of your doctoral thesis that you've spent the last several years working on that tie into culture and Russian culture. And as you've been watching this, there have to be different ways that you're feeling or interacting with it as well.
Yeah. I'm definitely not a Russia expert, but I looked at Russian culture and particularly the interaction between the U.S. and Russia after 9/11, and looking at kind of the incredible differences between the way the U.S. approaches the world, kind of, you know, in general American culture, and then how Russian culture, and then how Putin in particular approaches the world. Yeah, and so I think for me there's this sense of tragedy also, just in that things could have been quite different, could have gone a different way, and some of the ways that events unfolded over the last 20-something years. And then I think also this kind of feeling of being not quite an expert, but having a lot of knowledge about something also has raised for me the question of, like, should I have known more, or should I be doing something more, or should I have something to say beyond what I feel like I do? And which, when combined with cultural transition, there's the whole thing of role deprivation. And so when you combine role deprivation with this, you know, kind of crisis of, do I even know anything about the things that I'm supposed to know something about? That hits personally in kind of a weird way.
I think one of the challenges that we've had to learn living in a second culture is that we often tend to interpret things through the culture that we're most familiar with, which is our own, and then read in motives onto another culture. And I've seen that even in response online to what's happening, people that will be saying, well, of course they responded like this. How would you feel if you were in this situation? Or people reading in or interpreting motives of people from Ukraine, interpreting what's happening through American lenses. And I always think, boy, take a step back. We just can't know everything we want to know. But I find myself, sometimes that paralyzes me as well, because I think, well, I don't really know their motives or their interactions. And I can only imagine what that's like, saying, I know more, but I don't know how much I can interact with this. One of the things that's happening in Berlin is, because Berlin has been for a very long time a railroad hub in Europe, within days, Berlin was receiving refugees. And the average has been 10,000 refugees a day that are arriving in Berlin. How have you heard about people in Berlin responding to the refugees coming, or what are you seeing from people in Berlin that you know?
I think, yeah, from a newbie perspective, it's been interesting to see the expanse, like that it's like people care and it's affecting them and they're wanting to do what they can. And that at times looks very similar to things that we would see in the States, whether that's gathering items that are needed or fundraisers or you name it. It's probably been a thing that's happened. So, I mean, even our kids' school is now, you know, doing an item drive. Yeah. So it's been interesting to see that even as new people that we're in circles where they're like, people care and they're doing what they can and they're, yeah, trying to support the people, not just the political side, or they're not just giving opinions, but they're like, no, we care about the people that are affected.
I've seen a lot of, there's a whole lot of people that want to do a lot of things. And something that I've learned through this particular crisis is that the German ideal of planning is being very helpful, because there's a recognition at the very beginning that this is not something that's going to be over in just a week or something. And so a friend of ours is, she's very organized. She created a list, a spreadsheet of people who have place. So like an extra room or an apartment that they know of where they're able to host some refugees. And that with that list, also people who have time or capacity or different things that they're able to offer, with the idea that this isn't about just having a place for people to overnight, but also for people to be able to have time to get through the shock phase, to then also have resources in the community where somebody walks beside them. And so that's something that I've seen firsthand. And then the notes that show up on our apartment, the very front door, saying, please donate. We'll be taking things ourselves. Different organizations within the city that are working together, and we were able to partner with one of them. There's so much grassroots. Yeah, it's dwarfing government response from what I've been able to see, because it's something that so many people feel personally here.
Well, and I think government response to some extent is limited because they don't have a lot of housing. But even today, I read that the city of Berlin is right now caring for more than 20,000 people, which is a big government response. But if you think of 10,000 people a day showing up, and not all of them are staying in Berlin, some of them are passing through. And so that's part of this housing response that Alyssa was talking about as well, is some people are staying for a day or two until a plane arrives or until they can catch the next train or whatever. And other people have nowhere else to go. And so even who has long-term housing and who has short-term housing, and what you do with someone for 2 days is really different than what you do with someone for 2 weeks or 2 months. It's been neat to see the response from people initially.
And I also think there is no government on this planet that would be prepared for this type of crisis. It hits so hard and so fast. And so it needs all the regular people to step up.
There are more than 10 million displaced people inside of Ukraine right now. 2 million of them are in Poland, have come into Poland, which is a neighbor country, shares a border with Germany. And then where they end up going is uncertain, but then many of them are coming to Berlin. So you're absolutely right. There's no government that can suddenly handle 2 million people walking across a border and saying, please, please care for us.
That was interesting. So Hauptbahnhof, the main train station, is somewhere that I go to or through somewhat regularly, go out for walks or whatever. We have gone a couple of places recently. And when I've been in Hauptbahnhof recently, just the presence of refugees, there's just so many people. And then there's also so many people that are helping in the yellow vests or the orange vests, or, you know, and then there's, you know, suddenly a tent outside for helping process people. And there's these big, great big, I don't know, theatrical lights from the outside lighting up the Hauptbahnhof, and it says "We stand with Ukraine" in English. And so it's just, it's interesting how, interesting isn't the right word, it's overwhelming walking through a very familiar place and seeing it. I mean, it's just dominated by this by this crisis, and has been now for weeks. I think the other thing that is really interesting from a culture learning perspective is, you know, as we're trying to get to know German culture, there's this, I don't know how to put it exactly, you guys can reword it, but this like value on protest and the demonstrations and seeing that in action in regards to this, both in terms of actual like people turning out for events, you know, to like the march from the Rotes Rathaus to the
Russian embassy.
Yeah, and then over to
the Brandenburg Gate.
Yeah, thank you. Man, words. We had language school this morning. So. but then also even just some of the creativity in some of the protest signs, you know, which ties in with the history of graffiti here, and, you know, just using absurdity to make points. But then also things that are less obvious, like flowers laid in front of the Ukrainian embassy, you know, things like that, that there's just very visible expression of concern and very visible expression that something has to be done. And so both this very real action as well as an expression of the need for action.
I think that's especially important in a city like Berlin, in a country like Germany, where you saw an end to a dictatorial regime through peaceful protest. And then it was very much part of the constitution as the new government, the United Government, was being founded, that people would have this right to demonstrate, this right to protest. And so in Berlin, I think, what is the annual average? More than 3 protests per day. And that's just something that's a very real part of the system. I think the challenge that I've seen Germany really wrestling with, and maybe not always understood from an outside perspective, is, I mean, remember, you have a country that was made responsible for one world war, was responsible for a second world war, has faced forced disarmament, and then voluntarily, in many ways, had disarmed, and had seen this peaceful protest have such real results, that in many ways they really dialed back their engagement in war, in military support. And so that's been the other interesting other side of as people are demonstrating and saying something needs to be done, the government also saying, okay, we need to start spending more on our military and we need to start supporting.
The shift in that from, so the it was a Monday that Putin declared those two republics to be independent states, right? And then Thursday was the day of the real big invasion. And I remember on that Thursday, Germany was very clearly saying, we're not going to send weapons because German weapons can't be used in a conflict. So we'll send like helmets or something like that. And by Sunday, that had changed. So within 3 days, that had changed. And then that Sunday was also when there was the first really massive protest and the decision to spend, is it $100 billion on?
Euros, yeah.
Euros on the military. And that, you know, it, then being able to, through podcasts and other things, watch that kind of shift, this huge shift in how does Germany relate to the world.
And increased NATO spending as well as part of that.
It's pretty much an earthquake that's happened.
And I don't think that people from the outside can always understand how disruptive that is in the life of a lot of German people who have had one expectation for their governments and have voted in ways that have expressed desires to have that continue to take place, and that to be suddenly shifted has been disruptive and maybe is reflected in some of the demonstrations as well.
It shifted, but then also with huge public support, right? Like almost 80% of the public in Germany supporting those decisions to basically rearm and engage in those ways.
Which I couldn't have imagined 6 months ago, if you would have been having a conversation saying, do you think that military spending should increase, that the majority of Germans would have been for that?
Absolutely not.
This is the second major influx of refugees that Alyssa and I have experienced in Berlin. In 2015, we saw the Syrian and other Arabic-speaking refugees fleeing from the civil war in Syria and not coming usually directly to Berlin, but then being sent to Berlin, coming to Berlin. And I just remember some of the disruption in my day-to-day life that caused, not like, oh, I can't find things I want in the supermarket, but just the emotional disruption of seeing just lost people on the streets of Berlin, not knowing where to go or what to do, which you would think is normal for tourists. But the neighborhoods that I was seeing them, these were new residents in the city, that just remembering how heart-wrenching that was for me in 2015, the first time I experienced that. How are you guys seeing that or experiencing that here in your first year in Berlin?
I think something that comes to mind is just how, so over and over again, we're like, you know, we feel little changes just because our change radar is pretty high. Yeah, as we're adapting and figuring things out. So on the one hand, you know, it seems like, well, it's not in our country, it's not in our city, so it shouldn't change our day-to-day that much. And like literally just the little changes, it's like it's not as much, but then it does, and you realize like the separation isn't as far as you think it would be. For example, one of the kids' teachers that they really appreciate is Ukrainian, and she's going home. Like she's stopping teaching to go home and be with her parents, help her parents out. You know, I don't know the details, but that was just the thing. And I'm like, oh, they're sad about this. Like, so in our, again, like no comparison to what's actually happening, but then realizing like, oh, we are close enough that it is impacting our day-to-day feelings, emotions, and that then adds on to the transition of like, okay, what's normal? Like, well, this isn't normal in a regular year because this doesn't happen all the time. But this is added on to all of the other things that are, we're trying to figure out what is normal and not normal and how do we go through life.
Yeah, and there are also with our kids' school, they sent out a note saying to that they're planning on taking in refugee children, you know, they'll be beginning in class there, and kind of hinted at some opportunities maybe to help, and hinted because they're still trying to figure out what that looks like. And so I think for us, like we don't really have our feet totally under us yet. And so trying to think about, okay, do we have the capacity to respond? You know, can we be helpful in some way, whether that's at the school or in some other way? And then I think, I mean, there's also things like, you know, one of our colleagues sent out a note saying, hey, just, you know, can't find oil in the store. And yeah, you know, sure enough, the oil that we normally use isn't in the store anymore, and other things have a limit on them. Yeah, I think that on the one hand is like totally understandable, you know, that they're putting a limit, like that's good to keep people from hoarding and whatnot. And at the same time, it's like, you know, I think when things were like during the lockdown with Corona, when we were living in Minnesota, there was always kind of a sense of if we can't find anything, we can always go, you know, somewhere. like there's always, you always kind of have in the back of your mind, well, where else could I go that I could be more okay than I am here? And from here, I'm like, I don't really know the answer to that. You know, like if we can't find toilet paper, we just might not have toilet paper, you know, like, you know, if we can't find oil and flour, like, I don't know what that looks like. Like, I don't have any backups, if that makes any sense. And I don't, in some ways it's very, very small. It doesn't feel like it's really a big disruption, but it definitely compounds when we're still trying to get our feet under us.
That's different than with the Syrian refugee in this situation. And there's probably reasons for that. One, I think, just everybody's mental health situation is much more fragile now than it was in 2015, coming after a lockdown and experiencing some of the shortages at the beginning of the lockdown here too. I think people react quicker. I also think you can't underestimate the fact that you have tens of thousands of refugees that are setting up house that have similar diets or similar cooking ingredients to what they have here in Germany. And when they all hit the shopping stores, certain products, the staples, flour and oil, are going to disappear. But man, I remember early in the lockdown, I have zero idea when stores get restocked, but I know now when my local grocery store does, because I was like, that's my best chance of getting toilet paper early in the lockdown. Or if I want flour, I need to be in on these days, because that's when the grocery store is getting restocked. And it made me really respect the logistics of a city and having grocery stores in all of these neighborhoods and how much work that is and how devastating it would be if that was completely cut off.
Right. Well, and then, yeah, Ukraine is such a supplier of some of those things for, you know, so much of the world, including Germany. And mm-hmm. So, yeah. And then thinking about people, you know, the very small disruptions that we're feeling, and then thinking about what that looks like for people whose whole city is cut off. And I think that that's maybe the toll that feels very invisible, is just this constant weight of feeling connected. And maybe another difference being here compared to being in the States is when we see the videos of the shelling in Ukraine, the neighborhoods look like our neighborhoods.
Yes.
And so, yeah, when you see a great big apartment block on fire, it's like that looks like so many apartment blocks that we, you know, transit by on a regular basis. And that is very different, you know, where we were living in Minnesota. I've seen almost nothing that looks like where we were living before. But now, you know, all the pictures, it's like, yeah, that's, gosh, so familiar looking.
We live in a former Eastern Bloc country. So the exact same architects and city building planning that happened in Ukraine happened here. And so then it does make it feel extra personal because so much looks so familiar.
Alyssa, what are some other similarities or differences that you're seeing between this refugee influx and the last one that we experienced?
This one is so much more sudden. The other one, it felt like it was more like the tide coming in, and then you have to make adjustments as the tide comes in. It's very, like, so many things are affected, and there were over 1,000 people that were coming in per day at the height, I think 1,500. Mm-hmm. And so then it felt overwhelming, but like you could all kind of catch your breath in between. And this one, it's like, it feels like a tsunami that just went bam, and it's here, it's now, it's current. There was no buildup for the flood of people that needed a safe place to put their heads. So that's one of the biggest differences for me. Interestingly enough, some of the same systems that were built during the height of the refugee crisis with Syria, those have literally been reactivated. So like websites that had gone dormant, email lists, they're turned back on and they are being used to help get information out, to connect volunteers, to connect refugees. And so in some ways we're more prepared for this. And so that was something that good that came out of that horrible situation. So that, those are some things that I see that are very similar, but there's a sense of this is happening all over again, but also, no, this is something different.
I think that's really interesting, the reference to a tide coming in versus a tsunami. And I think that's probably in part just geographical, right? I mean, if we would have been in Turkey or in Greece in 2015, we would have felt very much like we were experiencing the tsunami.
Yes.
And now other European countries will be getting more of the tide, but we're experiencing it. A little more sudden. Well, it's been almost a week since we were able to record this, and we wanted to be able to get this out as quickly as possible. So releasing it in two parts, this is episode one, and then hopefully quickly next week, I'll be able to get part two out to you as well. Please continue to pray for us and for the situation in Ukraine. Like we shared, there's nothing here, we don't feel like we're in any danger, but we are seeing a lot of refugees, and we want to be able to interact with them in a way that is honoring and glorifying to God, and we could use your prayers in that. If you would like to ask us questions or interact with us more, you can join our Discord server or send an email to podcast@envisionberlin.com, and we'll be sure to answer those and get back to you as quickly as possible. Unterwegs, the En Route podcast, is a property of Envision Berlin and is recorded at Sprig, Envision Berlin's creative space. Please like, subscribe, and share. Podcast music is by Mike Piccinato.